Welcome to the Tiger's Den Podcast. We share leadership conversations that build trust, interdependence, genuineness, empathy, risk, and success in the workplace, along with on-target training and business tips so you can learn on the go. Here's our host, Diane Crampton.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us in the Tiger's Den. Today, we are discussing empathy, which is the fourth of the six Tiger's principles required for outstanding group performance. The other five Tiger's principles are trust, interdependence, genuineness, risk, and success. If you are a Tiger's licensed facilitator, HR director, manager, team leader, or business owner, we will be discussing why empathy has a huge impact on team performance and leadership excellence. We will also be discussing what happens when empathy is missing. And quite frankly, when it's missing, it's a big deal. With me on our call today is Dr. Christine Allen. Dr. Allen is a licensed psychologist. She has special expertise in improving communication, leadership development, team building, and in helping women succeed in getting a seat at the table in the work world. She is also an adjunct faculty member in the psychology department at Syracuse University and an associate clinical faculty member in the Department of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Chris is the president of the New York Psychological Association Division of Organization, Consulting, and Work. She is co-chair of the New York Psychological Association's Leadership Institute, which trains young psychologists to be leaders in their work and communities. Christine is well recognized for her distinguished service by the state of New York and has moved beyond her clinical work to coach executives through the International Coach Federation. So we are discussing empathy today and what happens when it's missing with someone who has seen it all in the clinical level and in the workplace. Chris, it's really wonderful to have you join our tribe today.
Well, thanks so much, Diane. I really am looking forward to our conversation.
Well, me too. And you have such a distinguished clinical career. And I'm interested, and I think our tribe would be interested, in knowing why you made a shift from clinical work to working in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell people a bit about that, even when I do some of the training and teaching that I do, because it's important not only about me, but it's important in terms of how I would like to see the world of work and our workplaces change. It's part of the reason I made this switch. Back when I was getting my degree in psychology a million years ago, I was training to be a clinical psychologist, and my father said to me, he said, well, if you're going to be a psychologist and not an engineer, at least you could be an organizational psychologist. And I said to my dad, I don't want to be in business. I just want to help people, Dad. And so I went into clinical psychology out of a motivation to try to help other people. And I know from my my career with my clients and patients that I was very helpful and helped a lot of people who were in some serious trouble. Sometimes it was temporary and situational. Sometimes it was long-term based on trauma or bad genes, a combination of things. But I always ended up feeling like, not that I wasn't satisfied, I felt good about that work and worked actually in some different kind of institutional settings, hospitals and things like that, but I felt like I heard things that my clients were saying about what was happening to them at work or how they felt at work or when they felt disengaged at work. And I mean, many of these people were very successful people that were at high up positions in their organizations, whether it was an academic position, whether it was a business company, a hospital, people who did really important things for a living that made decisions that affected lots of people, and they felt unsupported or disengaged at work, didn't feel treated well by their boss. So they were playing on Facebook, or they were online shopping, or they were calling in sick or having too many mental health days. They were just unhappy at work. So they weren't productive. They weren't being as successful as they could be. They weren't happy. And I think the workplace, you know, had tremendous amounts of, you know, kind of lost opportunities for both financially and in other ways of being successful. So I realized a lot of the work that I was doing indirectly, coaching people around how to manage relationships and how to manage their own success at work. And so I thought, with a little bit of extra training and skill, because I'm a person who's a firm believer in adult learners, and I never feel like I always could know more. So I got some additional certifications and trainings and began to do some training and teaching in the workplace and got some coaching certifications and started to do work with people in the workplace. Now, you know, there's probably, depending on the study you read, a significant episode of anxiety or depression, which is what brings most people into counseling or therapy. Mm-hmm. One in two people, lifetime incidents. But the number of people who seek out a counselor are about 4% of people. And so you think about how many people really, truly could benefit from psychological skills or increased emotional intelligence, self-awareness, but they're not going to probably come to see someone like me when I was in my private practice. So I figured I'd go to them. So that's what I did.
Well, and that's a great story, because when we think about people at work, and this will tie very well into our topic on empathy, when we think of people at work, oftentimes people spend far more time at work than they actually do with their families. When we're talking about their awake hours, their productivity hours, and their responsibility to bring home the bacon, so to speak. And
right.
At that same time, I've blogged quite a lot about the reasons why people have such high stress episodes, let's say on a Sunday evening. It peaks. It's like they're going
mm-hmm.
back into the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one of the reasons, too, why when I transitioned my career out of management into consulting,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to see an improvement in the world of work. When I was first doing my research on effective group behavior, the studies, and I think this is what is so right on about your transitioning into the workplace, the studies that had the most impact on group engagement did come from the field of psychology. And this is where the Tiger's definition of empathy came from.
Hmm.
And the way that we defined empathy, and it comes right out of my research, was the ability to imagine what another person is feeling or their circumstance and the desire to understand it, whether you agree or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, mm-hmm. from the clinical level, can you add to that definition?
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the definition because of a couple of key words you use in it, is that I like the word imagine, because what it means is, to me, is that you're really asking someone to view something from someone else's perspective. And so psychologists tend to define empathy as having both that cognitive component and the emotional component, they call the affective component. So when you imagine what someone else is experiencing, you know, I think that means really taking their perspective. But then you also put that word in there, the desire to, can you say that part again? The desire
the
to.
The desire to understand it, whether you agree or not.
Right.
In other words, you may not be in a position where you have to agree with them once
right.
you understand them, but that desire is there, and,
right.
and they know it, and they feel it, and they experience
that's right.
it.
And I think that's because, to me, desire is a feeling. So there usually mm-hmm. is a cognitive and an emotional part to empathy
mm-hmm.
where we can imagine what someone else feels like, and we feel some of it. And that desire to understand and to feel what someone else is feeling doesn't mean we do have to agree with their perspective. But clinical psychologists often says when they have like a patient or a client who's really in deep pain around something, I hear you. you know,
yes.
And that it's really like saying, I feel you, I hear you, I get you, I see you. And so, and people, that's something that's both at a cognitive and affective level. Doesn't mean you have to agree with what they think, but, so I like your definition very much.
What I've found also is that when that desire is there and people do feel heard,
mm-hmm.
oftentimes conflict tends to resolve itself. So once a person feels heard, sometimes that's all that's needed.
See, that's right.
As long as people are trying to use a leverage or a power position mm-hmm. to get to agreements in the workplace, I think that, in a way, builds resentment
right.
rather than
right.
understanding.
Right. It builds walls and it decreases cooperation and collaboration and even kind of creativity, because when someone feels heard and acknowledged and they're not being resistant, you know, they're not needing to push back, then there's a whole lot of possibility for mutual solutions. So I just don't think, and again, my clinical background and not having been in the business world for that long, I think that what I see is that people don't, I mean, it's great what the Tigers model and what you all do and teach, because people that I see in business aren't thinking that way. They're thinking about, how can I convince you or persuade you that your position is wrong, and, you know, to my point of view, rather than trying to understand yours, and then therefore you're more open to a different point of view.
I actually created a mathematical formula for it. There's
wow.
times when you are in relationship, what builds relationship is not necessarily agreeing.
Right.
What builds relationship is understanding that comes out of the conflict, because then that understanding can actually create a much larger solution, like you just referred to,
mm-hmm.
that is sometimes more creative and more workable. But you mm-hmm. know, Chris, when I look back to when I first started in the world of work in my early 20s, it seemed that from a leadership standpoint, sometimes decisions have to be made where a lot of people lose.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in the past, and when I first started work, I had executives tell me that they had to make sound business decisions, and the people side of that decision, the people who were affected by that decision, shouldn't take it personally because mm-hmm. it was just business. It was like they took their power and that leverage that comes from being in control and
right.
made decisions without regard to the impact it had on people. And it was referred to as a sound business decision, and that
mm-hmm.
people shouldn't take it personally because it's just business. And then I asked them, how would they feel even back then if the situation were flipped? And I often was met with blank stares, like, well, mm-hmm. why would I ever be in a position where this would
right.
flip? Yeah. On the other hand, I have worked and I've seen forward-thinking executives who had to make those same tough decisions. In fact, one of them was a large defense contractor who had to lay off literally thousands of people because of Mikhail Gorbachev's decision to stop the arms
mm-hmm.
race. So there was a peace dividend decision here that
mm-hmm.
resulted in thousands of employees.
Mm-hmm.
But this forward-thinking leader wanted to do so with empathy. In other words,
mm-hmm.
it had to be done. It's not
right.
like you couldn't
right.
make that decision. But that empathetic process then was decided upon by the executive team,
mm-hmm.
which then actually launched some of the first transition activities for employees who were let go.
Right.
In other words, it wasn't just a layoff. It was a layoff with actionable responsibilities based on empathy.
That's great.
I'm curious, you know, over the years, we have seen, well, it's a sound business decision. I don't necessarily need to take into consideration how it affects others. Two, it's a sound business decision that we have to do. Same situation, layoff,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but with different results. And I'm curious
mm-hmm.
how you see this leadership going forward.
Well, I think, and obviously it's something that you, through your research and your experience, have seen this shift over time. But
yes.
I think with the world as it is now, this virtual world, this instant world where we have this global marketplace, we have diversity, like we're dealing all the time, businesses, people working together on the same team who are from vastly different cultures, everything is ultimately relationship-based. And, you know, the leader is really serving, you know, the people on his team or her team, not the other way around. So I don't think you can be successful unless you have empathy and awareness. And you can't make decisions and toss people. I mean, it's almost laughable to me that somebody, and I believe they actually did say it, but could say it's not personal. How can it not be personal if I got laid off and lost my job and couldn't pay my mortgage? I mean, that's personal. You know, it may, and is it a sound business decision? This day and age, yes, layoffs happen, but when you show that kind of empathy and compassion and care by extending those kinds of services to people, people are often in a state of shock when something like that happens. They need that, not only the outplacement kind of, you know, help them get their resume together, but they need somebody who really reminds them that this is a layoff, this is not your fault, and to not lose their confidence. And so to really have empathy for that kind of anxiety that they have or discomfort they have, I just think it is a good business decision. It makes solid sense. And it's also, in my point of view, the right thing to do.
And I agree with you. I think it is also the right thing to do. And I think we're also at a paradigm shift between
yeah.
sort of the old way of doing business, I'm boss, you're not, to
right.
I'm boss, my job is to help you be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So we have mm-hmm. a huge shift between, and very possibly senior executives
right.
who have been brought up through the old school way of doing things.
Right.
And now the type of leader that will be attracting talented millennials into the workplace and advancing and developing their careers.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the coaching of an executive that's been brought up the old school way, that still
mm-hmm.
has the power, still
mm-hmm.
has the prestige, are you seeing huge shifts in organizations toward coaching these individuals or possibly even letting them go?
I, even in the 10 years or so that I've been doing the coaching, I've seen this shift. And again, I think it depends geographically on where you are. I'm in upstate New York, but the shift away from coaching that's really counseling disguised as coaching, in the sense of this person's kind of in some trouble, and so we're going to bring in a coach. I've seen even upstate New York, many organizations, both large nonprofits like hospitals and academic institutions, as well as, you know, corporate entities, banks, and other kinds of engineering companies, think about how do we help our high potential people develop? How do we provide the kind of support and develop, help them become more self-aware? What are their strengths and weaknesses? How can we help them be better? How do they, what kind of synergy do they have with other people on their team? How do we kind of capitalize on that chemistry? So I see a lot more forward thinking about coaching viewed in that kind of positive light. I had to learn even as a therapist that, you know, you can't, not everybody can change. You know, I would say the vast majority of people can. But again, the key thing about change is really wanting to change, motivation. The old joke, how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. And it's true with coaching, too. So, somebody's got to be motivated to say, hey, I never really looked at it this way before, but this is not, I got this 360 feedback. This is not how I want to come across. I even had one senior VP said, I read Daniel Goleman's book on emotional intelligence. I understand it, but I don't know how to do it. And he had gotten, you know, people thought he was too critical and too competitive, and his direct reports didn't want to work for him. And he made huge changes, and it wasn't natural for him. It wasn't easy for him, but he was motivated. He wanted to be a better person and a better leader. And he had the support of his company to do it.
Right. So therefore, you can train people to be more empathetic. Beyond a person wanting change, mm-hmm. beyond that, how can you teach people to be empathetic?
Mm-hmm. Well, this particular executive is a good example. I mean, I think your model and the way you define empathy is great because, again, what you're really asking someone to do is to practice taking somebody else's perspective. There's lots of opportunities to do that, and I even read some research recently that watching shows like, I think it was Mad Men, and I can't remember what the other one was, increases people's emotional intelligence. Just the act of asking, what do you think that person, they could ask them watching TV, what is, or even turn the sound off, what is this person, what is the emotion? See if you can learn to recognize emotion in people. And I think a lot of people feel anxious when they see emotion in other people, so they move away from that person, or they just get focused on the solution. They don't know how to respond to it if they've never been taught how to just how to encourage somebody to say what they're feeling, or even to be able to reflect it back to them. You seem upset. You know, is there something I said that, you know, didn't sit quite right? This particular executive went to all of the people, the peers who were the hardest on him, the direct reports, he went to everybody, and he said, I'm in coaching. Here's what I want to work on. I know I haven't been, you know, he had a lot of humble pie. He went and said, I know I'm not always, I haven't come across as caring. I really want to be better. What is it that you need from me? How could I be a better leader? You know, he kind of fessed up and said, I'm getting coached and I'm, you know, and people were so wonderful. They were gracious. They wanted to help him. So it was a good strategy. He also did some volunteer work. You know, he would normally just be doing, like, his volunteering would be, I'll compete in some kind of company race for something, yeah. and then I'll come in first, and I'll, you know, I mean, that's how he went. Instead, he went and volunteered in a soup kitchen and brought his daughter. He said, I really liked it, and I want to do it again, and I'm not doing it to look good. And I think having a safe place, a coach that can both challenge you but also support you in giving you some specific tasks that you can do to practice.
So he had a desire. He wanted to become right. more empathetic and more effective. But there was an element of humility, and then also his ability to listen probably
right.
improved.
And these were hard, hard things for him. I mean, he was the person who talked too much in meetings. He always wanted to be right. He had different assignments that he would, you know, not correct people, that he would sit in the meeting and not say something till asked. It was very hard for him to learn to listen. That's one of the reasons people truly didn't like him very much, is because they always saw him as looking out for himself. In fact, when his coaching contract ended, he was so worried that he'd slide back that he hired me to be his coach himself outside of the sponsorship by the company. And so we gradually kind of spread out our sessions more and tapered. And I said, you know, if you need me, you know where I am. And so I think he knew that still didn't come naturally for him, but he had gotten a lot better.
Right. And so he was willing to self-reflect. And he was willing to be,
right, that's it.
Have an element of humility. He was willing to listen, and he desired the change. And mm-hmm. possibly, you know, the highly competitive individual, when you look at team dynamics, it's nice to be able to channel that competitiveness into taking top market share in your niche in the world. It's difficult, I think, for people who have been brought up to be highly competitive to make that shift into collaborating.
Yes, I'm sure you have seen a lot of that.
Right, so. Right. And I think the organizational culture also can help empathy, because if mm-hmm. it's a very internally competitive culture,
right.
where people have to win, they have to win their position, they have to win their recognition, they have to win, oftentimes it's difficult in that competition to be empathetic, because if
right.
you're going to win in some companies, it's win at all costs. Difficult to imagine what it would be like to flip the situation.
the rewards have to be aligned in some way that make it them not have to compete so much within the organization. I think the reality is that, too, people sometimes say, that is there such a thing as true altruism? And I think the reality is like when you think about children and how children develop, there's not a distinction. We want children to feel good helping other people. It's okay to feel good. There is a reward in doing things that are helpful. There's experimental, hard data that when we do something nice for someone else, they are likely to do something nice for someone else. And it has ramifications way beyond. It affects dozens of people outside of our circle when we do something kind. And I think groups that are helpful and collaborative, they do outcompete other groups. They do perform better by not competing internally and helping one another. Personally, I'd like to see the point where we get to the recognition that we are all on the same planet. I mean, we may be getting there, unfortunately, in a very difficult way through some of the terrorism and some of the climate change, but to see that we are all part, you know, we all are going to have to find a way to be empathic and collaborate with one another in order for our whole planet to survive, you know, that's a different level. You know, I'd like to see us get there, too.
So it's interesting. You've got the individual who has been faced with the issue that you have to change, and they're self-reflective. They're willing to be humble. They are willing to do the work and accept the coaching from others. Are there people who are non-empathetic and that they might show up extremely well in the interview and they can make really good impressions and they can schmooze like crazy? Are there people who are non-empathetic that can cause group dysfunction in the workplace?
Yeah, I think absolutely there are, and I think there are different forms that can take. It seems to me that there are people who are what you'd call star performers, and they're very, very smart, and they're very successful, but they leave a trail in their wake, and sometimes organizations and teams think, oh, it's worth it to have this person because of what they bring. I think overall, on balance, if you read research on that, that it's usually not necessarily worth it to have that kind of a person, and that's just sort of an arrogance or a narcissism. I do think there are other people who have that capacity to imagine what other people are feeling, but they don't have the emotional feeling component. And there is all of the research on mirror neurons that when you laugh or smile, that the same parts of your brain that light up are lighting up in my brain as well. You know, we watch someone on TV swing a tennis racket. The same parts of our brain light up as the person who's actually swinging the racket. So that emotional connection to other people, I think, is very biological, and some of us are wired more that way than others. I think there's a very, very, very small percentage. The research varies, like 1 to 6% or something for narcissism, but that might have much less emotional reactivity. So they're more vulnerable in families, particularly, that would reinforce that. Families that over-recognize or over-reinforce a child's sense of specialness, that shame a child for their fears, make them feel inadequate, not let the child show any insecurity. If they already have some of that less sensitivity, they're vulnerable. And the one who's the star performer and who's just acting badly and I'm so great, I get away with it, in some ways that's just more overt and easier in some way to figure out, should we just let this person go? How do we contain this person? But the person who's more, you know, kind of psychologically manipulative or exploitive can be very harmful. And I think ethically, you know, you see some of these corporations where people have just, over the last 15 years, some corporations that have really had some terrible debacles because of extremely, I'll use the word, sociopathic tendencies in a CEO or a senior executive.
If a person cannot self-reflect, they can't see how they were party to a situation,
right,
and they're always blaming others for the problems, I think within a group that would just be crazy making.
Right.
And then in any organization, small department level, group level, all the way to the C-suite, if you have that predatory behavior, sociopathic or however you want to define
predatory
it.
Predatory is a good word.
I think that is extremely damaging to a team. In fact, in the book Tigers Among Us, I did an interview with this business owner. He actually hired a psychologist, Chris, to help him develop a line of questioning within his interview, employee interview process or licensee interview process, so that he could avoid that predator or the narcissist that would create real conflict for the organization, especially if he was selling a franchise to somebody who was of a manipulative nature or maybe a larcenous nature, would steal money from others. And so if you were to give any suggestions to our listeners of how to develop some interview questions that would help them find more empathetic people.
Right. Have spent some time thinking about that, because one of the other things I do as a licensed psychologist, obviously one of the things that distinguishes psychologists from other kinds of helping professions is our assessment background. And so I do sometimes do hiring and selection kinds of assessments, and part of that would be a structured interview and part of it might be an empirically validated instrument that I choose. We all have vulnerabilities to derail. There are no perfect people out there. Mm-hmm. But there are easier and harder ones to have in your organization and on your team. So sometimes I do try to help people find those kinds of things. I think in an interview, I mean, one thing you can do, again, there's the recommendation for using, you know, behavioral interviews where you ask not hypotheticals, but ask about a past situation. Tell me about a time when you, and you could say, you know, you might want to ask about, you know, a positive question. Tell me about, you know, a time when you had a problem, you know, with someone at work and you were able to help them out. Tell me about a time, you know, that you, a problem at work where you might have felt a sense of failure, and how did you handle that? And what you're really looking for or listening to is how they, their own use of emotional language, their own ability to be humble, their ability to admit that they made mistakes, you know, and again, you know, with that person who is more predatory, it can be difficult, but I think you can often be able to see some of that genuineness in the kinds of responses and the quality of the emotional response that you get from the person.
You triggered a couple of things that come to mind. Worked on a healthcare merger, and it was a very difficult one. And one of the issues that had come through customer service surveys is that this triage team of medical responders to accidents and tragedies did not display empathy.
Mm.
We're talking just triage level anesthesiologists and nurses and just incredibly talented doctors. And so they had an opening after the merger came together. They had an opening and had decided that empathy questions were key to their interviewing process. And they had asked, and this is this performance-based question that you just referred to, they had two finalists that they were taking a look at. One had just a stellar Ivy League college background, and the other did not have quite as a stellar a college background and had more lower level work that had been done with patients in the past. But the question was, can you give us an example of how you deployed empathy in your practice over the last 3 months? And the person with a stellar Ivy League education was absolutely stumped.
Was stumped
by the question. It was like, well, I do precision work. I do absolute precision work.
Right.
But the other person could just say, well, yes, in this situation, it was a horrible traffic accident. There were lots of people gawking around, and I grabbed a blanket, and I shielded the person from view.
Right. That's such a great, I mean, just, that's ironic that even just asking the question directly flummoxed the person who didn't know how to do it or
didn't get it. It was like, what does empathy have to do with the precision of medical treatment? It's hard because when you look at it potentially in the medical community where there is such a life-death situation, how do you think an empathetic person can shield themselves from burnout?
It's a great question, and it's an area of work that I do some work in, and I'd love to do, just like the getting women a seat at the table at the workplace. This is another area I feel very passionate about because I've been at some level in healthcare my whole career, and I think a lot of caring people do burn out, but it's partly because, you know, even in a hospital or a healthcare system, you know, there aren't any models or structures in place for many physicians and nurses to be able to have a place to talk about what it felt like to lose a patient, what it felt like, you know, to have an unsuccessful surgery. They don't have, and there's research that shows when they have, you know, they are paired up with another physician, or they go to a small group and they take a half an hour a week, or they journal and reflect on it, that it reduces their burnout. It makes them feel happier and more satisfied. It's just not the way business is done. And I was asked for a radiology unit to come up with like an empathy sensitivity training because some of the medical technologists, again, they were trained and hired for being, and they prided themselves on being technically precise, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to miss the tumor. You know, I'm going to get it right. But this is some of these interventional radiology. And they're young people or older people. People are frightened. They're frightened of the test. They're frightened of being the test. The results, they're frightened that the tests will hurt, they have to be somehow exposed parts of their body, and the radiologists are just reading the results, they're not the ones there with the patient, and so to really just help them with some basic things about helping them feel safer or more comfortable or be able to ask questions, but it requires empathy. I mean, it really requires empathy, and so I just think it's a huge area where we could get better.
I agree. It's almost like there's a line between empathy and sympathy. That empathy is that desire to imagine what another person is going through and that desire to understand that. And sympathy, which can, in my view, blur the division between understanding into wallowing in it with somebody. Does that make sense?
I think it does, but I also think that, you know, sympathy can also come across as condescending. Like, you see yourself as other or different than me. And so you're feeling, you know, pity or sympathy for me instead of feeling like walk a mile in my shoes. And if you understand how that patient feels or how that person who's losing their job feels, you know, it doesn't mean you can't make the tough decisions or deliver the tough information, you know, if you're a physician having to tell somebody they've got a really terminal diagnosis. But, you know, I just don't think people, like you were saying earlier, our culture, both our work culture and our culture generally, people just have not been taught or raised to have those skills. They don't know how to do it, so they avoid it. And most people are very well-meaning. There are some of those people that are going to be exploitive or manipulative, or just think they rock it, the narcissist. But I think most people just don't know how to do it. With the support and the help from the organization saying, we'll give you the training, we'll give you some coaching, I'd say, and I don't know what your experience is, but most people are motivated to do it. They want to be better.
But we're talking about how you really teach people at an early age to recognize empathy and to become more empathetic. I'm wondering, especially with your psychiatry and psychological background, your understanding of how the brain works, is there a difference between men and women?
Well, the research overall is kind of equivocal. Depending on the study that you read, you can find sometimes there are gender differences, and a lot of emotional intelligence research finds that there are aspects of emotional intelligence, particularly that social intuition, other awareness, which is empathy would fall into that, that women often outperform men. But most brain studies don't really overall find that there are reliable differences between men's and women's brains. I think there are more individual differences between two people's brains than there are between men and women. I think our culture really socializes girls and boys still today really differently. I've seen it, but there's an episode of 2020, I think if you Google that, you could find out, in 2007, where it was on TV, where this developmental psychologist is interviewing boys and girls, and the social psychologists are always tricking people. So they gave the boys and girls lemonade that had salt in it instead of sugar. The boys are like very direct, this tastes horrible, this is to a stranger. The girls are saying, oh, it tastes wonderful, you know. And when the very famous anchor asked the girls, why did you lie and tell me it tasted good? I didn't want to hurt your feelings. I didn't want to be rude to you. The psychologist then, UC Berkeley, the psychologist then went into homes and found that girls who were in families that encouraged them to be more assertive and boys who were raised in families that encouraged them to be more empathic and thoughtful, that those differences disappeared. So I don't think it's biological. I do think overall it's just the way we've been socialized.
Well, then when we talk about that socialization and when we look at our children, and obviously our children grow up and now they're in the workplace, at what age do you think that people actually begin to experience empathy to where it can be reinforced?
Yeah. Well, I think that, again, that emotional component of empathy you see very early on. You can see even in, 18-month-olds and sometimes even 1-year-olds, certainly 3-year-olds, that they'll comfort, you know, they'll try to comfort another child that's crying or a baby that's crying. I think by the age, depending, there's some studies as early as maybe 4 or 5, certainly a little bit older, 6 or 8, where you really can, they can take the other person's perspective. They are able to know that somebody else has a different state and a mood state. But I think, you know, it's just as a parent, I have college-age children, but, you know, I would always ask, well, how do you think, you know, Jimmy would, you know, felt when you took his toy, and how do you feel when someone doesn't share with you? So I think that it should be reinforced all the time, and it should be reinforced equally with boys and girls instead of giving boys and girls really different messages, like more competitive messages with the boys and with girls. You know, don't confront the situation, basically, because you don't want to hurt Susie's feelings.
Okay, so empathy is a state. It actually is a state of a human's development.
A development.
As opposed to a skill.
Yeah, an underlying trait, you know.
Right.
Right. But again, I think like many traits, again, we're not going to completely change our spots, but we can develop even in areas that are not as natural to us in terms of traits. But I think that emotional intelligence I definitely view as a skill. It bothers me even that it's called an intelligence because, again, some of the emotional intelligence instruments out there rate you like on an intelligence scale. And I think it's discouraging to people. I think there are different components of emotional intelligence, and I do think it's a skill that we can get better at. I think empathy is an underlying, like you're saying, a trait, but I think people can learn to be more empathic.
I think we're coming to the pretty darn close to the end of our conversation, and I'm curious, Chris, of two things. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, thank you so much for asking.
Yes.
I can be reached at Chris@InsightBusinessWorks, InsightBusinessWorks.com. I can be
Is that Insight or Insights?
Insight.
INSIGHT.
BusinessWorks.com. And I can also be reached at my phone number, 315-727-8881. People can also reach out to me on LinkedIn, although I'm much more likely to respond if you send me a personal message with your invitation. And I'd be really happy to talk with anyone who's interested. And I am so honored and privileged that you asked me for the conversation, and it's been just a really interesting conversation.
Well, I think so, too, because empathy is something I think that's on the top of people's minds right now.
Yep.
And people don't quit companies, they quit bosses. So we've got to figure out why that is. Is there anything else, Chris, that in the minute that we have or so left, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you would like to say about empathy?
I don't know. My heart was touched today just because today is the day after the Brussels terrorist attacks, and I saw a picture of a little boy, a refugee in some, I don't know exactly which camp or which area, trying to get into Europe, and he had a little sign up and said, you know, "We're sorry, Brussels." And it just really touched my heart, you know, that even somebody who's in a really tough situation himself in a rainy, muddy camp could feel for those victims. I just thought that's what we need more of in this world, is that kind of empathy.
Well, that was a very valuable ending. Thank you for a valuable conversation today. It's been wonderful having you on the call.
Thanks, Diane.
We've been talking with Dr. Christine Allen, a psychologist, educator, an executive coach, on the topic of empathy. And to our listeners, thank you for your time, attention, and interest. From the Tiger's Den at CoreValues.com, I'm Diane Crampton.
You've been listening to The Tiger's Den, which is an educational service of Tiger Success Series, Inc. We've helped conscious leaders build more cooperation among employees and collaboration between departments for over 25 years. Tell your friends about our topics and join us regularly by subscribing to our newsletter on the web at CoreValues.com.